Beyond Shakespeare is sponsored by the Malone Society, the permanent utility of original texts. Go to malonesociety.com for more information. Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we're going to be talking about, well, are we talking about radio? Are we talking about audio drama, because it's the term radio is doing a lot of work these days that sometimes it's not technically doing, as it were. Anyway, we're going to be talking about radio drama, specifically not talking about the subject of my guest's book per se, but how it intersects with what we at Beyond do and the overlaps there. But there's a wonderful book that my guest has produced, which is a very, very good introduction to the nature of audio drama and adaptation for audio drama generally, and is a really entertaining read. But without further ado, my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
That's a very good question. I am Dr. Andrea Smith. I work at the University of Suffolk in Ipswich on the east coast of the UK. And I teach there, but I also research audio drama, specifically early modern plays. That's my interest. There is a particular playwright who I have particular interest in, mainly because there's so much stuff. But there's actually quite a lot from a lot of his contemporaries, and I'm fascinated by that too.
Shall we start with radio? Shall we start with radio drama in general? Because I think you and I have had very similar starting points with early modern drama and radio. I mean, I've listened to radio all my life and radio drama, both on the radio but also released on various media as well. But that use of an audio adaptation when studying a play, which you talk about in your book, and I immediately went, yep, that's exactly what, and one of the reasons why this podcast exists is the opportunity for people to be able to, those who are studying, not everyone listening is studying early modern drama, but the ability to read along while listening to a performance is something that is incredibly useful. I'm a great advocate for that. So that's something you cover quite early in your book. Is that a good place to start?
Yes, it is. I mean, I did my, I came to education, higher education later in life. So I had a whole career as a journalist for nearly 30 years. So went straight from school into that and did my degree with the Open University. And Open University at that time was supplying you with audio CDs of plays because you couldn't easily, you know, you couldn't go on a group trip to go and watch a production. So therefore, you listen to them at home. But I found this so useful because when you're sitting reading early modern drama on your own, with, you know, particularly you haven't got classmates around you, you're just in your own home or wherever you are reading it, sometimes it's quite tricky. Mm. You kind of need, as soon as somebody says it out loud, you go, oh, that's what it means. That's what they're saying. Because the combination of the intonation, them knowing the meaning behind it, and just, I mean, I've said this a few times to a few people, I act as a magic as far as I'm concerned, because they have this ability to take something that on the page that can feel slightly impenetrable. You get very used to it. And these days I'm quite happy with early modern drama. But particularly when I was starting, you'd sort of go, I'm not quite, what's this about? There'd be some reference that was very specific that you didn't get, or the phraseology was odd. And you hear an actor say it and you go, oh, that's what's going on here, or that's what this means. Or just even things like, oh, they're being ironic, or they're being duplicitous, or what. There's so much you can get from a voice that you can't get on a page. And obviously these plays have very little in the way of stage directions. Mm. So there's often very little around that. You know, a modern play will often have quite a lengthy discussion of what this character is like and how they will sound and look and all the rest of it. And these plays don't. So you don't have that guidance. So, yeah, actors are brilliant at bringing that alive and helping you understand it.
Mm. And early modern drama, or a lot of, I mean, we're mostly going to be talking about playhouse drama from the Elizabethan onwards. But there are great advantages to doing audio versions of these, in the sense that a lot of them, as a producer, I spend a lot of the time going, okay, character comes on stage and immediately someone either says their name or they say their own name in the third person. So they tell the audience who they are in very dynamic ways. And so much of the text is carrying you along. There are also disadvantages to trying to adapt these for audio, in the sense of the vastness of the casts, And there are particular problems with audio drama in terms of we have fewer signifiers to play with, where on stage you can play around with things a lot more, and it's harder to double convincingly in audio. And also, every so often, you just have a dumb show, which you have to decide what you're going to do with.
Yeah, a dumb show is interesting. And believe it or not, there is a production where they left the dumb show in, which was utterly impenetrable. And this was late 20th century. This is not an early production where you're going, oh, they haven't quite worked out what radio is yet. No, it's a fairly well-known late 20th century production of a play of this period. And for some reason, they decided to leave the dumb show in. So you just get some random noises about that. It's bizarre. But the things you pick up on there, so things like cast. The BBC, which has obviously been the biggest producer of audio drama over the last century by a long way. You know, America's produced stuff and other countries too. But, you know, the amount of audio drama they've churned out in the last 100 years is absolutely phenomenal. And they've done a lot of plays, a lot of quite obscure plays actually as well, not just the ones that we've all heard of. The BBC, I believe it might still exist in a very small scale, but at one time had quite a large rep company. So you'd have actors who knew how to do radio and were hired partly because they could do different voices. You needed actors who, your lead actors would be distinctive and would probably only play the one part, but you needed a company of other people who could adjust their voice, adjust their accent. There are quite a lot of female actors who would double for the boys in these plays. And surprisingly convincingly, actually, it's quite odd because if you listen to boys' parts in these sort of plays and you hear them done on radio from the 60s, say, you go, well, that doesn't sound like a boy. And then you watch a film of kids from the 1960s, you go, that's not what kids sound like, because they all sound RP and they all have this kind of strange public school voice that, you know, so actually the women were just mimicking the children. So you've got that going on. BBC is also interesting in that there was for a long period of time, essentially producers could kind of do what they wanted. So you had producers who just went, yeah, I want to do all these random plays that, you know, most of our listeners have never heard of. Yeah, let's do it. Or let's have a whole season of Christopher Marlowe. Now, you know, Dr. Faust is quite well known. Perhaps even now, Edward II is sort of gaining a bit of traction as a play. It's being done a bit more frequently. But, you know, let's just do all of Marlowe. You think that seems slightly crazy, really. But because, you know, well, who's going to listen? But people did. And that's the other thing about radio drama, particularly mid-20th century. You're talking about maybe 12 million people listening to a radio play. I mean, that's enormous. You know, you wouldn't, I mean, TV dreams of that. I'm not going to pretend that radio gets that now.
No. But, well, nothing gets that now.
No, nothing gets that now.
We have such an atomized culture. And radio's part in maintaining a connection with our historical theatrical culture is, I think, really important. I mean, television is part of that conversation as well. And that's sort of one of the reasons we exist, is sort of because those audiences and those broadcasters aren't doing that kind of work anymore, there is a real die-off now of productions on stage, because of course if a production has been on the BBC or on television on ITV or one of those channels, even if you didn't watch it, you've heard of the play. And actually we're now in this situation, unless we can co-opt some large-scale media interest, these plays are sort of dead in the water because nobody's heard of them anymore. I think legitimately a lot of people have never heard of quite a lot of Marlowe anymore, in the way that, you know, I'm going to say his name. We can bring him up occasionally. You've been very good. As a guest, you've been incredibly good, because it's like I said at the beginning, you know, we can't discuss this other guy. And then 5 minutes in, it's just like, I don't know why I bother. But you've been incredibly good. Your book is called, I should actually say, the book that we have been dancing around is called Shakespeare on the Radio, A Century of BBC Plays. So, you know, let's get that out of the way. But yeah, just trying to get an audience means you have to be using some kind of mass media output. And okay, we're only a small podcast, but potentially we have a much wider scope of appeal than a theatre production ever will, even by a major company. And that's where the BBC was so important, and that's where the public service remit comes in the sense that it's not just that producers are able to do, you know, potentially left on their own to do something, you know, it's part of the remit to do drama. And across different radio stations as well. I mean, remember, there used to be a time when all of the BBC radio stations did drama.
Yeah.
Which, until recently, was still vaguely true.
No, I mean, it was, you know, and if they didn't do drama, they had comedy. So when I was younger, Radio 1 still had comedy in it, and Radio 2 had comedy in it. Mm. Losing Radio 3 drama, so for those of you who do listen to the BBC Radio, may well become aware that BBC Radio 3 used to be the home for these plays, basically. Yeah. If you were going to hear Edward II, Faustus, I mean, recent ones, Malfi, those sort of plays, Ardna Faversham, those plays would turn up on Radio 3. Mm. And that Radio 3 no longer has drama. And it is a question I personally have been asking to people at the BBC to say, what is going to happen? Where are we going to get these plays now? Mm. Because one kind of weird little quirk that happened during COVID is that suddenly we got more of those plays and less of your man's plays. And I don't quite know why, but we got a repeat of A Mad World, My Masters from 1983. Yeah. I don't know. That suddenly, I think because there was no new drama, it was like, oh, let's grab these things out there. It was kind of quite odd. And so there was Arden was just before, I think. There's Malfi. There was a few others. It was a reworked version of Bartholomew Fair, which is a Johnson play. Mm. And there was a reworked version of that called Bartholomew Abominations. Mm. And so it was kind of quite peculiar because suddenly the other guy wasn't being done and these plays were.
Yes, the fact that there is an archive, I mean, that can be drawn upon, is relatively recently those Marlowe productions we're talking about were actually released digitally as a box set. And it's the kind of thing that has been made available in a limited degree. I mean, there's some Middleton was released as well. And there might be more that I've just missed. One of the problems is because of the wide-ranging scope of everything, it's quite difficult to hunt for it. The advantage on a branding level of the other guy is that it's a one-stop shop to hunt for things.
Well, you say that, except BBC Sounds, which is the platform they want you to use to find their audio, you search the other guy's name or even any of the titles I've just given, they probably won't come up. Mm. If there's been an episode of In Our Time on them, that might come up.
Yes.
But they don't, because they're all filed in their system under Drama on 3, which is obviously now defunct.
Yes.
So again, there's a big question over this and how people can access them. Mm. And because I work in university, I have access to something called Learning on Screen. Mm. And they have a lot of this audio. They have pretty much they have a lot of plays from about 1970 onwards, audio plays, and particularly the most famous ones, the ones that people... But a lot of these less well-known ones, my guess would be, are not even digitised. Mm. Because I know when I was doing my research for the book, some of those hadn't yet been digitised and they digitised them for me so I could listen to them. Mm. So, you know, I've got my little list in front of me here and I've got things like, you know, Dutch the Malfi, 1947. Don't know whether that exists. If it does, I guarantee you that hasn't been digitised. It's too early. Mm. So some of these will be kind of, some of them will still be sitting there on big reels of tape or even like LPs. They're not LPs, but you know, that kind of on disc.
Yes.
And again, BBC was extraordinarily late in going over to any kind of digital format. Mm-hmm. So I used to work for the BBC. I didn't work in drama, but I did work in comedy. And I worked in comedy for a short period. And this was around the millennium. Mm. And I still had to supply my programmes on reel-to-reel tape. Mm. Even though I was recording it digitally. Because they didn't trust digital formats at that time. So I recorded my stuff digitally and then dubbed it onto reel-to-reel tape for playout. I have no idea if they still have those reels. But I mean, storage is a problem then.
Yeah.
So again, we don't know which plays to exist. We don't know in what format they exist. Mm. And BBC has made quite a lot of cuts to its archives recently. So getting access to this stuff is getting trickier and trickier. Even if you can say, I'm a researcher, I need access to this, it's getting quite tricky now.
Yes, and if we go back to the beginning of the BBC, of course, a lot of stuff doesn't exist because it just wasn't recorded. So, you know, BBC Radio has been going on for, over 100 years now. And yeah, that evolution of how radio drama is produced which you cover quite a lot of, the changing styles, the changing production methods. There's some very elaborate methods of production that seem incredibly complicated to me.
Are we talking early days stuff here?
Yeah, early days stuff. Yeah. The way that they build these production or put together production studios that are sort of all compartmentalized in really, yeah, really confusing ways.
Well, it's because if you think about how we now digest audio, we're used to hearing it mixed together, cross-fading. Mm. So if something fades down, the sound goes down and the sound comes up in another place. Now, to do that, the only way they could think of when they built Broadcasting House, which is 1932, was, well, we'll just have lots and lots of studios then. So actors would have to move from one studio to the next. So you'd be in one scene, and then that would enable them to fade down the microphone in that little booth and fade up a microphone in another little booth. So there would, you know, there was like a half a dozen rooms, and you might have to go from one room to the next. You wouldn't stay in the same one because you'd then need to be with another actor in another scene where they could fade you up again to do the next bit. So I know it's quite crazy some of how they used to work things. But I mean, again, kind of weird thing about the kind of COVID thing was that, so when they decided to bring production back, so people may have seen photos of people doing radio. You see one big BBC microphone, lots of actors standing around it. And after the crazy cubbyhole thing, that's basically what they did for like 80 years, which is everybody stood around with a microphone. COVID happens. This is no longer safe. So they basically go back to doing cubbyholes. They hired studios and put everybody in a separate little cubbyhole so that you wouldn't be in contact with the other actors. This kind of full circle thing keeps happening. And again, you know, I listen on headphones now. People in the early days listened on headphones. We seem to have gone back weirdly to how things were 100 years ago.
Yeah, that evolution of technology and what people have. And in terms of adaptation as well, the question, I think it is a bit of a problem for us as well, though it's a bit different for us in the sense of, an audience's expectation or critic's expectation about fidelity to a text and changes, adaptation, interpretation, how much music, how much sound effects, all of the things that we do as to who the audience is, who the expectations of the audience is. Now, we're a bit different because we do effectively an uncut version in a very rough form, and then we try to soup it up, and then we make cuts and we tweak around with it. That's the ideal. It doesn't always happen. It depends on how much time we have. But obviously, if you're a broadcaster, you're just broadcasting the thing. And those sort of conversations between who is the audience, who are the critics, what do the critics want, what do the audience want, who is listening to this, create a lot of problems, I think, for the producer.
I think there's a kind of scale where the better known the play, the bigger the problem. The less well known the play, the more changes you can get away with making.
Yes.
it really is as simple as that. Because, you know, there's things that I mentioned, Bartholomew Abomination. So this is this reworking of Bartholomew Fair. Unless you are a fan of early modern drama, it is done occasionally. They have done it at the Sam Wanamaker, and I saw it many, many, probably nearly 30 years ago at the RSC. It does get done occasionally, but it's not a well-known play. People don't really know the plot. It was utterly reworked and set in the 21st century when they did it on radio not so long ago. I think if you took something, it was very interesting when they did Duchess of Malfi, which was only a few years ago, in that they stuck very much to the text, but they did use modern music. And there was an introduction at the start saying, don't be surprised it's not lute music. This is a really rough and ready play, and we've put in modern rough and ready music to kind of make you feel the kind of visceralness of this play. I don't know whether there is any backlash or not. I'm not aware of any. But it is that kind of almost having to let the listener know, okay, we're going to do something slightly different. We hope you're going to be okay with this. Here we go. And certainly the more famous the play, whoever it's by, the more picky people are about, well, this bit's missing and that bit's missing, and you've taken out my character and you've changed this one, you've conflated these people. And in, like you're saying, huge casts, you kind of sometimes have to go, we've got to roll characters into one, because if we had, you know, six different characters, how on earth are we going to cast that? If we can sort of meld them all into a single character.
Yes. And more importantly, how would the audience keep track. I mean, this is the thing, is there are only so many voices you necessarily keep going in your head. It's like with names. I think you can only keep about seven names in your head before it all starts going wrong on a good day. So yeah, when you've got a host of characters who keep coming in, telling you their name, and then it's another, and round and round it goes, especially if sometimes they're quite strange names. I mean, even some of them are very unusual. And just very briefly on Bartholomew Fair, I mean, it's interesting. I don't think anyone objects to cutting down, doing anything to Bartholomew Fair. It's about 5 hours long, uncut. I mean, I don't think you can. I mean, we've discussed this actually, you know, doing a maximalist, you know, we're going to just hire a theatre and just do the whole play, but with really long intervals and food and drink. Because otherwise, what are you presenting?
It's a bit like Tamburlaine. Tamburlaine also enormous because it's in two parts. And and I think, yeah, Marlowe's Tamburlaine. And it's just that kind of, you do sort of think, again, you kind of have to cut it. But it's very interesting the way that you get kind of this, people get slightly nervous about cutting certain plays by certain authors because they're worried that people will get upset. And again, it's what do you cut? Whose speeches do you cut? You know, can you... something like Dr. Faustus, can you imagine cutting the stuff about Helen of Troy? I mean, you know, that's something people would kind of probably go, hang on a minute, isn't this the play with that thing in it? Yeah. Whereas other plays you can go, well, actually you can hack it about and nobody's going to notice because they don't know it well enough.
Though, of course, I would always argue that you should do Tamburlaine 1 and 2 as entirely separate plays and leave them relatively intact, because part two is really interesting. I think part two is, it's not necessarily a better play, but it's a play that's about something. Whereas part one isn't. It's just like, Tamburlaine, eat world. And part two is like, how do you keep hold of the world when your management style is just kill everyone? And then you apply that to your own family. So there is a temptation that I'm just going to repeat this. I've said this many a time. If you want to do Tamburlaine, just do Tamburlaine. That's fine. Don't conflate the two. You don't need to. The first one works fine. The second one actually also works fine. I'm not saying don't cut. It's already cut. They cut the clowning before they even printed it. So we don't even know what the clown stuff was. There were some jokes. We don't have the jokes anymore. You know, they took the jokes away from us. Sorry.
There are people who would be quite happy to lose early modern jokes.
This is true.
Yeah, that's a whole separate conversation. So yeah.
Yes, the question of can you find an early modern comedy that's not a tragedy? Well, I do say, you know, one of the great things about doing what we do is we do everything. One of the worst things about what we do is we do everything.
Yeah.
Drama production over time at the BBC, dancing around different texts, trying different things. I mean, one of the other reasons I do what I do is because of a series called The Thirst Stage from the 1950s. So John Barton, before really John Barton was John Barton. I'm holding up. This is makes great audio, by the way. I'm holding up the little booklet.
Beautiful.
That they sold for 2 shillings and 6 pence, or 6D rather, which was you could apply for while listening to it. And it has all the sort of introductory comments as part of. And the first stage was basically doing all of the early drama before the playhouses, either in full or trimmed down. It sort of gets up to the Spanish tragedy and then stops. And I don't know if you've listened to any of these.
No, I haven't. And the other one, while we're talking about big projects that they did previously, Vivat Rex. Are you aware of Vivat Rex?
Which has been released, and you can actually buy on CD, not
I
just
have
download.
It on my shelves.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Thomas of Woodstock action. Yes.
I do, isn't it? I think it's generational. I like a physical thing.
Yes.
I like to be able to hold a CD in my hand. I know that's a bit sad, but
with the first stage, because I knew about this because I was sort of wanting to listen to or watch early drama, and I couldn't. And I was reading through a thing about fragmentary drama from the early period, and it had listings of occasionally it's mentioned the third stage, and so. And then it was released on LP in the 1970s. So here am I, buying off eBay from America all these LPs, which was not cheap.
Yes.
I point out. But that is that sort of interesting intersection. That's sort of why I started doing this. It was like, I'm spending a lot of money buying it. It's actually almost cheaper to just make it. That in the mid-20th century, not only are you having stuff produced, you know, and relatively disposable, but things start to get archived and also things start to get commercialized. Things are released on LP, cassette tape, CD, through to digital download now. And that, again, connects with that whole thing we were saying at the beginning. That thing of being able to listen and use it as a source of study, and you know, home entertainment whenever you want to listen to it.
Yeah. It's funny you say home entertainment, because I'm nearly always on the move when I listen. It's really strange. So you also said at the start about, is it radio, is it audio? And I never know what to call it anymore, because I do listen live to radio plays, but frequently I'm much more likely to download it and listen to it when I'm moving, because actually often the time the play is on, when Radio 3 still had drama, the Sunday night slot, I was often, you know, getting ready for work the next day and those sort of things, and just, yeah, brain wasn't in the right place to listen. And again, Radio 4 still has drama in the afternoons while I'm working, so I'm not listening then. So I nearly always download it and listen. And I tend to find, for me, I listen better when I'm on the move. There's an amazing number of people who say, I love audio drama, but I do fall asleep in it. Because there's something kind of actually quite reassuring, relaxing perhaps about it. And if you're just sitting still, I kind of often I'm on the move. And a lot of the research I did for the book was done, it was researched during COVID, and so I would go for my daily COVID walk listening to audio drama, and that was how I did the research, and made notes on my phone as I went along, and then copied them all out when I got back. So
and actually the absence of a commute during COVID actively hurt downloads.
Yeah,
it's like, yes, people were doing the walk, but so many people are listening to things on their phones, either in the car or just on a train or something, and listenership actively went down for 2020 when we were doing what we were doing, and a lot of other podcasters I was talking to at the time were saying the same sort of thing, that it's part of our routines, but those routines are different. Radio being in the background while you were doing, you know, maybe doing household chores, you know, and things like that. I still sort of do that. You can't do it when vacuuming, but
but I mean, I'm the same. I have it on when I'm doing stuff. Is frequently the way. This tells you everything you need to know about me. My idea of a treat is I need a break from the work I'm doing. Oh, I'll listen to some audio drama, which is also actually the work I'm doing. But you know, it's a change. The change of what I'm doing. So, but yeah, and again, it's that I love hearing different. I mean, one of the things about radio drama, so many plays have been done so many different times, and everybody brings, just like if you sit on stage, every production of a play will be different and will bring something new to it. If you can listen to more than one production of a play, you get different perspectives on the characters, and one of my favorite plays is Arden of Faversham, which I always feel is a very peculiar play, because it feels like a really black farce, and then it's a tragedy, and you're like, what happened there?
Because they spend the entire time going, we've got to kill your husband. Hi, would you like to murder my husband? Stop telling people we're trying to murder your husband.
Exactly.
And then they fail to murder the husband. Until the last three scenes, it is a comedy. I mean, it really doesn't seem to have any other function, especially when you tell people it's based on a truth. This all kind of happened.
Yeah.
That this is actually incredibly dark, very suddenly, especially as you have people who are sort of innocent in the background. It's not just Alice getting burnt at the end. It's the guy who delivered a letter once, and he went, I didn't know what was in it. I just delivered it. I'm just the postman.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to get hanged?
I've heard a couple of different audio versions of that, and I think it is interesting to see how much they embrace the dark comedy of the opening of that play, and how much they're trying to go, oh, this is a tragedy, we have to be serious all the way through. And I love listening to different things, because then you go, well, what do I think? How do I think this works? And again, go back and have a look at the text and what is there? And it's really interesting.
And what happens with a comedy when you're recording it with an audience, as opposed to, or a black
whatever you
drama,
want to call it.
with an audience, because we recorded Arden with an audience. And I mean, that's not out yet. It's still in editing hell. And but it is getting there, honestly, listeners. In fact, actually, by the time you hear this, I may have already started releasing it. Yeah, that question of, you know, you've got an audience. An audience is a component of this. Should that be an element? And actually, I don't know how many plays generally have been recorded with an audience, because sometimes people do record things with audiences.
Very rarely. They have occasionally been done, and sometimes it's because it's been done as part of something else. So there was, they certainly did, I think it was for the World Service rather than the mainstream BBC, like the UK BBC. I think it was, they did it at the Globe, and so that was done with an audience. Certainly they've done a production of, well, Mendelssohn's, we'll say Mendelssohn's Midsummer Night's Dream, shall we? We'll put it like that.
it's okay, we can talk about it.
Mendelssohn's. But they did that with actors then reading quite large chunks in between music, and that was with an audience. But it is still it's still pretty unusual for the BBC to do it. Again, I suspect at least part of that is cost, but also part of it is maybe there's an element of, do you want the intrusiveness? It's interesting because a sitcom would always traditionally have an audience. You know?
Well, that was my thinking, is if we picked comedies that we actually thought, you know, would function as comedy, that you could do a 5-episode sitcom, basically.
Yeah.
You could present it in that fashion. And that might actually, I mean, I don't know whether the flow of the action would pick up each episode, but you could definitely record it, that, because that's one of the questions we've been asking, is actually, do we explicitly hold back comedies for an audience rather than try and do it in studio? And we've been doing a lot with live audiences, just simply because we've been doing a lot of stuff with live audiences rather than any artistic reason. It's an interesting sort of artistic choice, that actually the volatility of an audience is perhaps actually not unimportant to these things as well.
There's also a kind of weird phenomenon, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, when you're either listening to something, you're in a theatre, everybody else finds it funny and you don't.
Yeah.
And weirdly, that makes it less funny. Mm-hmm. And I have certainly experienced that both listening to stuff and also in a theatre, where I suddenly become aware that I'm the only person who doesn't find this funny. And that makes me find it even less funny than I did before I realised that. Mm. And we have a kind of odd relationship with humour, I think, and how comfortable or not we are about laughing at stuff. And I will walk along the road listening to stuff, chuckling away, and I kind of think, I've no idea what people think. Never mind, eh?
Yeah.
because I will enjoy it. If I'm enjoying it, I will laugh. So there's a slightly interesting thing around comedy, I think. And again, you have that kind of, if an audience in a theatre, and a lot of us have experienced this, when you've gone to see a play that's supposedly a comedy and the audience are just not getting it.
Yes.
And as one are not reacting. And that makes it incredibly difficult for the actors.
Yep.
But again, if you're recording, it would make it incredibly difficult for anybody listening or watching it later.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it is definitely hard for us, because if we are recording with the audience, we're only doing it once. And it's very hard to do comedy once, because you haven't quite tweaked. It's also even harder when you're doing an early modern play, that the jokes might just not land. It's just like they need a certain explication, that there's only so many footnotes you can give an audience in advance. There's nothing like explaining a joke to make them so much more funny. So there's that sort of problem. But that said, if it's a total disaster and nobody laughs at all, you just pretend there isn't an audience, and that's how you do your mix. The only problem is if they laugh once, then you're in trouble and you can't take it out of the mix.
The one other thing that I must admit I do like about listening to early modern comedy is that you can't have the visual gag. And one thing you do get when people do these plays on stage is they try rather too hard to make a visual gesture in order to make a line funny. And that can be quite painful, because they're trying.
There's a lot of hip thrusting on innuendo.
I was trying to think, how do I phrase this? And other such gestures, yes.
We try to eschew that as much as possible for obvious reasons, but it's also quite interesting how a play can change if you don't tell people it's a comedy. We did a play called Jack Juggler, which is hypothetically a very funny situation where somebody is pretending to literally be somebody else. It's like, he turns up, hi, can I get in my house? No, you can't, I'm you. I'm you. And he starts basically beating him up and knocking him against the wall, saying, who are you? No, that's not right. I'm me, you're not you. And of course, on stage, it's supposed to be funny and it comes back. It's all a really enjoyable little gag. But when we recorded it in studio, it just comes across as some sort of weird existential crisis. It comes across as something much more disturbing because you don't have any of those sort of cues in place to say, well, this is sort of knockabout comedy and that's how it's supposed to function, rather than just, yeah, I'm just having a personality crisis here of I don't know who I am anymore.
I think darkness comes over very well in audio, actually. Yeah. And there's something about it can be really conspiratorial. Mm. Because most of us listen on headphones.
Yeah.
Suddenly you've got the bad character. They've got a soliloquy. If there's a bad character with a soliloquy and they're talking to you, they're talking in your ear, you are complicit with what they are about to do. Mm. It suddenly puts you right in the center of the play in a way that if you watch it in a theater, you are very much, I'm in the audience, you're there. Or if you're watching it on film, you know, that's where you are. There's a nice clear boundary here. Mm. Audio, you kind of lose those boundaries and you can find yourself feeling much more moved sometimes as well, and certainly much more ambiguous about some of the characters, because you can think, hey, hang on a minute, suddenly I'm kind of caught up in what you're up to. I'm suddenly part of it. You've told me, like, you've whispered in my ear like I'm your friend. And obviously they haven't, because they've done it, recorded it, you know, God knows how many years ago. But there's something about audio, I think, that can really make it feel much more intimate. And those sort of darker plays where you do get somebody, and particularly when you have, often in these plays, you get a character who is sort of both bad and good. There's a kind of mix, or there's a tension in them. And those sort of characters, you kind of think, well, I sort of want to be your friend, but also I think you're evil.
We were talking about, you know, multiple productions over time and different productions, and sort of also that crossover between radio and audio, because you were talking about Duchess of Malfi, you know, and I've got it was on tape, but this was an LP release. It wasn't I don't think it was a radio production. I think these were all specifically recorded. I could be wrong on this front. I don't think it's, this one has Robert Stevens as Basila, and the performance style of that and the recording style of that is very much, they're in a quite a big, relatively echoey studio doing text. There are some music cues. There are a fair number of cuts. That's quite a different presentational style to a modern, mixed-in, close mic. Plenty of those were capable of, and there are elements of that there, but it's like the producers aren't that interested in doing that.
Yeah, and it's very much, I mean, one of the things about audio is that the production team is so much smaller than it is on a visual production. So you wouldn't, you know, if you compare it to stage, for example, you'd have a costume designer, you'd have a set designer, you'd have perhaps a movement coach these days or something like that, you know, or a choreographer. There's a producer, there's a director, there's someone on the script, you know, a dramaturge maybe. In radio, there's just the producer and maybe a production assistant to make some technical organisational stuff. There'll be people running the mics for them, doing the recording, but essentially the person who decides on the cuts in the script, the performances of the actors, really everything you're going to hear is decided by one person in radio. And that's usually actually referred to as the producer rather than the director. And so, yeah, you get, again, it does often draw people to it who want absolute autonomy, they want total control, because they get it on radio. That's what you get. Mm. And so there are people, quite often with these plays, you'll see the same name come up as producer again and again and again, because they like these plays. They want the autonomy to do it their way. Mm. And it's kind of interesting, that kind of wanting to have total creative control, which in pretty much any other medium is almost impossible.
It's interesting about, because, I was sort of sitting there thinking, having total control, and I was sitting there going, okay, I am the nexus around most of what our production dances around. But I weirdly feel like I have no control over productions at all, because so much of it is, it's like I've just finished doing the mic plots for the live shows, because, of course, we have a limited number of mics, so everyone has to stand up and know which mic they're going to. It all has to be agreed in advance, because we don't have time to rehearse that on the day. We need to rehearse the performances. Editorial stuff is going through me, but it's also we have a process of, readings and ongoing processes that go on for years in the run-up, that what I'm doing is mostly technical, either technical text-wise or technical, technical-wise, don't bump into the microphone, please. please control your plosives.
It's interesting. I think different people take it differently. So there was a chap called John Tidyman who ran BBC Drama, for Radio Drama, for a while. And was hugely, it did work with everybody and anybody he worked with. He was hugely successful. We sadly lost him during COVID, actually. And I managed to speak to him only a few weeks before he died. And he was a fascinating person to talk to and about his work. What was interesting about him is that he very much just went, well, I'm going to cast the best actors I can afford and let them get on with it. That is not how some of his colleagues worked.
Yeah.
Some of his colleagues were very specific. And this is a much earlier example. There's a lovely example from the 1930s of a producer, and we still have this. We not only have his script, we have his 17-page essay to the cast with he's been through all the theory on this production, on this play, and he's decided how all these characters should be. He's outlining why he's decided. I mean, it's just like, it's very university. It's very kind of, but there was somebody who wanted total control in a very different way. There was somebody who wanted to absolutely make his actors give the performances he wanted. He knew what he wanted them to do. They couldn't just turn up and do it the way they felt the character should be. No, they got to do it his way. And so you get different people with different things. But essentially, yeah, you have still only got this one person at the core.
Yeah, and I generally call myself producer as well. I generally, if it's usually if we've got somebody else doing the directing on, the actual acting side of direction, they'll be called a director because, that's sort of what they're doing. And I'm still in the background doing the production side of things. I wonder also if it's just simply that I'm working with texts that by and large we don't have as deep a performance history. For me to, it's very hard to go in with certainty saying, this is what this bit means. By the time I finish the production, I might have a clearer idea. And we do these things called spoiler episodes where I sort of go through and I just try and do the meat and two veg of like, this is what this scene is doing primarily. This person's comes in, they're a bit sad. And you need a set here, or you need to, and how would you stage it? Which is something weirdly about audio, makes you think about what your staging would be.
Oh, yes.
Because we don't have costumes. We don't have set. And that's sort of frustrating, but it's also really useful to because then you think weirdly more about it than I think you would.
Yeah. There's a lovely thing. Alec Guinness talked about when he was doing a particular character and how he...
Which
he
said, I may or may not have listened to when studying that particular play at A-level.
He said that I have to remember when I'm in this scene, I'm wearing my nightshirt or something like that. It's kind of like he kind of to act the play part. He's imagining his own costume because that helps him think about how to put it over on the microphone. I think that's really interesting, the different mindsets people get into to help them do something. And so actually he's imagining how he looks physically, even though he doesn't really. But how he thinks he would look physically if he's performing this to an audience who could see him, and that helps him to deliver it into the mic, which is an interesting way to kind of think. And it is, I think you do, that thing of, sound is your set. Sound is your set. Sound is sometimes even your costume to a certain extent. Sound, you can use sound to indicate, if you're not careful, it turns into pantomime, but you can use sound to indicate certain characters. Opera does it all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, and some of these plays, you know, very famous. One of my favourite operas is Dido. It's not Marlowe's Dido.
No.
It's Purcell's Dido. But yeah, those kind of that kind of using sound to indicate somebody's almost their appearance and who they are.
Well, also, if there's, especially with early modern drama, you often have different courts. For example, we did Game at Chess last year, which I'm just sort of doing the simple edit of at the moment, which we had Raoul Fox, who created the music for the production, basically had a slightly different music palette for the white pieces on the chessboard and a different colour palette for the black pieces on the chessboard. So it's a matter of primary entrances and entrances there. There is a sort of hint in the music as to who is what. It's not just, here is some music that sounds terribly dramatic. That sort of logic is in place. And then also just the acoustic of the room. You're going from, often you have scenes where you've got very public speech. Someone is very aware that they are speaking in public. So you've got a bigger room they're probably talking in, and then they go with their advisors. And on stage, it would probably all be on the same set. But of course, in audio, it's like, door closed, slightly different room acoustic.
And when you don't get that, some of the earlier productions I've heard, they don't think like that. And there's a, you know, you go, well, hang on, is that person still in the room? Because I haven't heard them leave. And those two people are having a conspiratorial conversation and the other guy shouldn't hear this. So thinking it.
The nightmare of at what point do you stop using footsteps?
That is the thing, you know, do you use footsteps or not? Do you use door opening and closing or not?
Yeah.
How do you indicate it? But I mean, I think what you're talking about, that whole kind of, are you close into the mic? Are you a long way from the mic? Loud, soft, all those kind of dynamics really work. Stereo can be a really useful tool as well. So you can there was a producer called Raymond Rakes who pioneered the use of stereo in the BBC drama department. He particularly liked the idea that you could situate people effectively in different places, so that if someone's listening on stereo, those people on my left, those people on my right, I can see and understand what's going on. So you're using those kind of sound techniques. The other thing is accent is the other thing to use. You know, talking about, again, if you've got two sides two warring sides, what is often been done is you give one group one accent and one group another accent. And therefore, at least you know which side is talking.
Yes.
But the problem comes if they all sound the same within that group.
Exactly.
And then you have a problem.
That's the thing, is that we tend to have quite international company in terms of sort of where actors come from. So that they often will have a comfortable accent they can work with, which doesn't always fit that logic. And it's like, I'm doing an English history play. Well, we'll have to explain why the Italian has just turned up and why that's. And so sometimes you're sort of going, well, okay, maybe we won't do that, or, you know. But weirdly, I'm working on a production of Gorboduc, which is early English history of mythic history, where weirdly, I don't have that problem with accents at all. It's like it's far enough back that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And that's sort of my logic is actually, no, we'll throw an Australian in, it'll be fine. You know, that's
it is about, I think, if you, as an audience, you want to know who's who. That's a crucial thing. So you need to know who's talking. And if everybody sounds the same, and that is mid-20th century, there's a massive problem with audio drama from that period, not just this period, any kind of audio drama. All the actors are trained to have the same voice. And that's fine on stage where you've got costume to delineate who's who. And on radio, it is awful. And, you know, there are productions I've heard of things where you go, I've no idea. Even the lead actor, I can't tell apart from the other actors because they've all been trained to have the same voice.
And every so often you get it wrong and you've accidentally cast exactly the same voice.
There's a fantastic story about, can I just drop one S-bomb in?
We're getting to your official plug anyway, so let's throw it in.
There's a story about that I got from John Tiderman, actually, talking about the production of Othello. And he cast Nicole Williamson and Paul Scofield as Iago and Othello. And they're very well-respected actors in their day. What he didn't do, and this is unusual for him, but he hadn't clocked that they basically have the same voice. And so Schofield, who was playing Othello, because at that time it was acceptable for a white man to play Othello, did, I'm not going to use the term that was used, but he put on a voice. Let's just say he put on a voice. And it is truly, I just listen to it and go, I can't believe that this was deemed acceptable at the time. But this is the late 70s. But it got repeated in the late 80s. And you kind of think, what is going on? Why is this? And that's because, you know, they were going to both use their normal voices. And they realized that if they did that, you wouldn't know which one was Othello and which one was Iago. The accent choice was very, very poor. Let's put it that way.
To be honest, there's a little bit of that in the first stage. Let's just say there are some Jewish characters.
Yes, I've heard some plays with Jewish characters from the 20th century.
There was a lot of it about.
Yes, there was. Sadly, there was, yes.
Maybe it's a blessing that some things have not survived.
Yes.
Sadly, we have run out of time. But if you'd like to plug your book now, do tell everyone. I very much enjoyed it, by the way. So
thank you very much. You
know, I haven't been paid to say that. That's not sponsorship. I bought it with my own money. Do tell the world.
It's called Shakespeare on the Radio. It's published by Edinburgh University Press. It's very cheap for an academic book. It's 15 quid, and they can be really expensive. So it's very reasonably priced. Basically, it tells the story of radio drama through the lens of Shakespeare. So it goes right from the very first production in 1923, right up to the modern day, and talks about, you know, the editing of the text, the editing of the audio, the performances. There's some nice little anecdotes about various people, Alec Guinness's slippers, for example. There's very... various kind of things that kind of go along the way. And I really wanted to write something that would help people use Shakespeare and embrace Shakespeare in audio form, because I'm sorry to keep using the word, but because people kind of tends to be not thought of as academic. Audio drama doesn't tend to get thought of as academic. And yet it's hugely helpful for my students and for me. It's really to encourage more people to enjoy it from both an academic perspective, but also just because there's loads of this stuff out there. Go and listen to it. There's some, I'm not saying it's all brilliant, but there is some really brilliant stuff.
Yes. And actually, just a little note, a little pet peeve that I have, which is, and I'm not going to name names or anyone, but, you know, I produce quite a lot of stuff and, you know, of, you know, whatever quality it is, we do our best with the resources we have. But there is a sense sometimes you're in a room talking about a play and your production doesn't exist because it's audio.
Yes, that is very much the case, I think, in certain arenas, and it drives me nuts. So I'm very much the person out there banging the drum for audio drama in all its forms, actually. And that it should be recognised, because the skill that goes into doing it is different, but it's just as skillful. It's just as important. There's a lovely thing, Radio Times, which is the BBC's magazine. When it was still fairly new, I think it was the 30s, there was a big supplement in it on radio drama. And one of the actors then was bemoaning the fact that people think she just stands there and reads stuff. And she said, that's not what we do. And I thought, she's absolutely right. People think that radio drama is easy, that it is, oh, well, you've got the script, so it must be easy. The amount of skill that goes into reading that script so it doesn't sound like you're reading that script, so that it comes alive and so you're interested and care about these characters, it's huge. And then all the other things that wrap around it, that, you know, other sounds that you add. It's a hugely skilled thing. And yet, I think partly because radio has been deemed ephemeral for so long, people have gone, oh, it's just, you know, it's because it goes out on the radio, and for many decades, you couldn't get your hands on it again. It was broadcast once and that was that. It has this kind of, oh, well, it's not proper though, is it? Yes, it is. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
So yes, I would very happily cheerly for you and anybody else who's making audio drama, because I love it. And I think it should, you know, somebody said to me not so long ago, is radio drama going to exist into the next century? We've just had the first century of audio drama. Are we going to? And I said, I think so. I really do, because I think it will evolve and it will change, and what people want and how people digest it is going to change. But We still listen so much on headphones all the time. With so much of what we do in our life is, you know, we're driving in a car. You can't watch a video while you drive a car, but we can still be absorbed by a story. So it's still going to be here.
There's been a positive explosion of digital producers who are, you know, not tied to an institution like the BBC. And I don't think they're going anywhere.
Absolutely.
There was a time a little while ago, especially when as the American market sort of exploded a little bit more, where people had to explain what audio drama was to some people. And I think we're hopefully past that hump now.
It was very interesting because people were talking as if they'd invented radio drama. You know, within the last sort of 5 years, there's people talking about, oh, you do it. And like, oh my goodness, you've just reinvented something that was invented 100 years ago, and you're doing it the 100 years ago way rather than learning from the people who are doing it now.
Yes.
It's baffling, but maybe that's a good thing. People are rediscovering it. People, a new generation is coming along going, oh, you can do that with audio, which does mean it's going to be around for a good while yet, I think.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest, and maybe we'll chat again in the future when you write a book on the wider early modern stage at the BBC.
Do you know what? I would love to do that. So should that happen, I'll be back in touch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.